is okay. Now you can start.
Okay. And I tell people at these other groups that if they come down here on Wednesdays from 10 to 2, I'll pass on 100% of the discount I get on the material if they want to buy it. And thank you all. Well, I don't know if I remember that restaurant you're talking about, but a long time ago, Jeffrey was probably there with us. Thank you, Jeffrey, for coming, and good to see everybody, Chuck, both Cindy's, John, and everybody else. So my sobriety date is August 14th, 1986, and it wasn't a very happy day for me. But before that, before August 86, I had a few drinks. I grew up on Capitol Hill. I was one of nine kids, seven boys, and we had good parents, and they sent us, you know, St. Joe's, Seattle Prep, and then most of us were supposed to go to Seattle U. And I had a very, very difficult time when I hit my teenage years, because in years in AA, I've heard people tell stories of horrific childhoods, tremendous abuse of every kind you can think of. And I had none of that modeled for me. I had good parents who wanted good things for their kids, and I had to learn all that bad stuff myself. I didn't have anybody pass it on to me. But I was an eager student. And like we hear with so many people, the first real experience of alcohol I remember was probably 14 years old. And I was involved in the CYO organization, and they ran summer camps and stuff. And I was a dishwasher there. And the Catholic priest that was the chaplain, and don't get ahead of me because it's not going in that direction in any way. when the girls were in session, about the only boys in camp were the two boy dishwashers, and I was one of them. And so when they went on their overnight hike, he had a tradition. I didn't know it at the time, but we met in his cabin, and he had a bottle of Wild Turkey. And I was 14, and the other guy was like 15, and he started pouring his shots. Okay, it was the world was a little different back then. The idea in his head was we were going to get drunk and we were never going to touch booze again. So we got drunk, and I woke up in the morning, vomit all over the place. I just slept on the floor from wherever my chair was. Same with the other guy. And this priest came out in the morning and all bubbly and all that. And he says, "Well, boys," you know, he said, "do you want another drink?" And I thought, he's so cool. And the other guy was dry retching. And I don't know if he's ever had a drink since. But it, what it did for me, and I wish I could say this was mine, but it actually comes from Schuller, Mike Schuller. Mm-hmm. And when I met this man and he described what booze did for him, it was my story. And it kind of goes like this. I'd take a drink and my throat would just like warm, and I just feel that booze going down, you know, into my chest and into my stomach, and it felt so good. And then I could sing. As it went down farther, I could dance. Except, you know, I'm just a white kid, you know, I couldn't really. And then when it came up the backside, it gave me a backbone. And I knew what everybody else should know about any subject you wanted to pick. Mm-hmm. And then as it came up further, it cemented my brain with, hey, I want more of this. And then Mike used to say this, and I love it. He said, and then it combed my hair. Except it didn't do any of those things. it didn't do a single thing that it promised me it was doing, but it felt so good. And so to me, that's kind of like the feeling when people talk about chasing the high alcohol, it made me feel whole and it made me feel good. And I liked it. And so I drank and I got in trouble that kids in those days got in trouble for. I was going to be the first one in our family that didn't go to college because I just barely graduated from my high school class. I graduated from high school in 1970, so I was in the lotto. I was number 11 and no college. So if I let nature take its course, I was going to be inducted into the Army. And in my way of thinking, 8 weeks later on the front lines in Vietnam, which could be a real nice country to visit, but I wasn't in the visiting mood then. So I joined the Marine Corps for 4 years. And a couple of the things behind that is, one, I felt like I was doing something decent. I had an uncle, a great uncle, that was a chaplain in the Marine Corps during World War II, and he said mass under the flag at Iwo Jima. He was there when they raised the flag. And I knew him well until he passed. He was a Jesuit priest, and he was just a man of honor and integrity. And I thought maybe if I joined the Marine Corps, some of that will rub off on me. And of course, I'm drinking all the time. In fact, I came into AA when I was like 34, so 14 to 34, that's 20 years. I'm in the Marine Corps at 18 years old. And in my whole drinking career, that boot camp in the Marine Corps, I think, was the longest time I didn't have a drink, whatever it was, 6 or 8 weeks. And never did I want to try and top that record again. So also, I got married. I can't even talk about that story because it's so insane to me. Not that my wife was insane, just the idea that where could I have ever come up with a thought that I would be marriage material? at any rate, I got married at 19. I finished boot camp. Then you have this advanced training. And then comes the day where they read out the orders. And so, you know, our platoon's there and they're reading everybody's name. And finally, he just stops, the drill instructor. And he's looking at me and he's looking at the orders. He's looking at me again. And I'm thinking, what, you know, how bad can it be? And he said, shaking his head, and he says, "Meade, you know, military intelligence." And I'm thinking, well, God, that sounds kind of cool. but I thought he was going to hit me or something. I didn't make the orders. And so in those days, they shipped us off to an Army camp because they had the military intelligence school that the Marine Corps didn't. They just sent us there. And there was 14 of us from two different recruit centers. And what the lieutenant said was, the person that graduated top in the class could have his pick when the new orders came in for us. And then he kind of laughed. He said, "But you're all going to Nam anyway, because that's where all the orders send you." So there was a story that happened there. And here's what I want to tell about that. So I'm at Fort Gordon, where they have all these military intelligence schools and stuff. Fort Gordon, Georgia. I'd never been in the South before. And I remember getting there and thinking, wow, Civil War sites. There's so much cool stuff I can see down here. And then Friday night, I can't remember the day of the week I got there, they had a bus pull up to the front gate and it took you into a whorehouse. You know, they provided the transportation. And I'm thinking, I like this place. Except in the barracks, the barracks they put us at, we you know, stow away our belongings. They had these machines. And they had 16 ounces of ice cold Pap Ribbon beer for 10 cents.
Wow.
I never left the base. I mean, how cool can the Army be? So I like that. Never saw that in the Marine Corps before or since. And anyway, so through a series of events, I may have graduated number one in that class, but it didn't matter because I had it in from a different way with the lieutenant. Just anyway, I got my choice. And out of the, I think there was 14 of us there, 12 orders for Vietnam, one for Florida and one for San Diego. So I'm off to San Diego for my first tour. And so I'm feeling pretty good. I get, you know, I'm going to be doing something with my life. I'm not sure what, you know, I'll maybe figure it out in the enlisted men's club where they have drinks for a quarter or 35 cents or whatever they were. But growing up, my dad was an honorable man, and he was a man with integrity. And he would say that he didn't care what happened to his children if we were good people, from a street sweeper to a scientist. That's the value. That's what was important to him to pass on to us. And of course, you know, I was always in trouble. I didn't listen. So I'm checking into my first duty station, and I'm all squared away and whatever uniform I'm supposed to be wearing. And I go into the provost marshal's office, which is like the cop station where the people are. And I'm showing the desk sergeant my orders, you know, what? And he says, well, go through that door and the officer of the day or whatever they call it will be with you shortly. So I go through, and there's kind of a lunchroom back there and it's just some vending machines. And there was two or three MPs. And strictly as a joke, I could tell right away, they're kicking and beating the crap out of this drunk Eskimo Marine. He's on the floor, bloody mouth and stuff, and they're laughing. And they're standing him up and pushing him into one another. And I had never witnessed anything like that in my life. And I thought, this isn't right. This isn't right. And I'm not going to be complicit in even seeing this. And then I had this other thought that said, I got 3 years left. What's going to happen to me if I make some complaint? My very, 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 I hadn't been here 5 minutes. What's going to happen to me? And something happened that I never, ever, ever thought would happen. I just ignored it. And I was just filled with self-disgust. I couldn't believe I was capable of the type of person that would not just choose not to look at it. You know, I put my own self-interest first. And I didn't even try and talk myself into, well, maybe the guy tried to attack him before I came in, because none of that happened. Big, burly MPs and this poor, innocent guy. But what I did do was my days of an MP on duty, where we had run into the bars and stuff in San Diego and the border crossing at San Ysidro, you couldn't be any luckier if you were drunk than to get me as an MP. Because it's right back to the barracks, best friend, you know, unless there was trouble. I wasn't a person looking for trouble. I was a person that was looking for a way to get you back to the barracks without you getting yourself in any more trouble. Anyway, to me, that's how I justified a little bit on where I saw I had no backbone at all. So at any rate, I get out of the Marine Corps. I'm married. I got a couple of kids now, and I got a 4-year scholarship to Seattle U through a family connection. And how's that? I mean, that's pretty cool. Four-year scholarship, and my folks went to Seattle U, when it used to be Seattle College before it was Seattle University. My wife's folks went to Seattle U. Brothers and sisters went to Seattle U, so it's just kind of like now I'm in with the pack again. I blew that in 2 years, just from drinking. And my excuse, although I kind of pulled away from the family some, was, hey, I got, you know, whatever I had at the time, three kids or four kids, and I'm working, and I just don't have, I can't do it. And my wife's stay at home. I mean, it's not like laziness. That's just how they, back then, the husband hopefully could support the family. I don't know. I mean, I was drinking all the time, every day. But I was able to support my, you know, I was able to pay the bills, sort of. I started a relationship with debt back then. And for the next, we're going to be talking about decades. It's how do I get the money to pay these bills? And then how do I get the money to pay back the money that I borrowed to get these bills? So it wasn't like deadbeat where I walk away and leave somebody holding the bag, but it was a continual continual process of figuring out where the money's going to come from to get these bills paid. Then little did I know that through a party, you know, everybody drunk, I met this man who's later to become my partner, or I was going to become him, and we were going to do the Lord's work. And who would have ever guessed? So I just dropped out of school. And he said, well, Steve, what are you going to do? And, you know, I wasn't really sure. And he said, come to work with me. And I laughed at him. And I said, you're in the used car business. And he said, okay. And he reached into his pocket and he pulled out, you know, a wad of hundreds of, yeah, I don't know what, $5,000, $10,000. And he said, that's what we call walking around money. He said, empty your pockets. And so nobody laughed at the joke. That was supposed to be God's work, you know, some of these guys. I can help you along. So I went to work. I went to work with him, for him, and then with him. And we made a lot of money. We made a lot of money. He probably did something like John did. He invested in property. And he begged me, Steve, you know, we should, you know, go in on this, go in on that. And I would laugh at him. I had better things to do with my money, you know, spend it on... I couldn't tell you where it went. And that's the sadness of it. I couldn't tell you where my money went. I just didn't have it and I needed more. And that went on for years and years. And actually at one time, I was, I guess it was president of whatever we were, the Used Car Dealer Association. And I thought that was pretty cool. And we had a meeting. And remember, I'm president, so I'm sitting at the head of the table at this meeting. And it was at a Sherry's restaurant in Burien. And I had never been to that particular restaurant or anything. And so I get there, and I'm whatever the format was. They didn't serve alcohol there. This is like in, I don't know what year, it must have been like 1982 or something. They didn't sell alcohol. And I said, I couldn't believe it. I said, well, then, okay, a beer. Because I'm ordering, you know, like a double shot. So we don't serve alcohol here. Well, I'll tell you one thing. In the history of our used car association business, that was the shortest meeting they ever had. And never at Sherry's again. I didn't know restaurants didn't sell. So. Any rate, my drinking was every day. It didn't seem like I'm drunk every day, but I drank all the time. It would be unusual for me to be taking my children on a Sunday drive or anything where I wasn't drinking. to me, it was just normal. I never got a DWI. However, I probably deserved one 10,000 times. Just who can ever figure? Not long before I came into AA, a family had property up on Whidbey, and we were haying. We had 40 acres of hay, and we were drinking all day and haying. And then I remember right before I left to come back to Seattle, I had about 6 or 8 ounces of bourbon after drinking beer all day, just to kind of get me to the ferry and stuff, which was 5 minutes away. And I was going up the top of the ferry hill, and I thought I was going to pass out. And the blue light's behind me. And I thought, okay, I deserve it. I mean, there's no fight in me. I deserve it. So I pull over, cop pulls behind me, and he says, "Jesus, what happened to you?" And I had blood coming down, not kind of covering my eye. But I remembered, I think I fell down before I got in my car to come here. And like the real alcoholics, the lie came immediately. I said we were haying for my folks, and then we played a little softball afterwards. I got hit with the bat. And he said, "Geez, you better take a look at that. Pull over for a minute and calm down, you know." And I said, "Oh, thanks. I got to get back to the children." that was it. That was the closest that came. So I pulled over in case he was watching, you know, went into the 7-Eleven that's at the top of the hill, bought another 6-pack, and went home. Okay, so that was my drink. And I just, it was involved in every part of my life. Every day at the car lot, on my way home, in the evening, everything. So we bought a house on Mercer Island from where we're in Bellevue. And this is in 1981 where I got to pay the annual percentage rate interest was 15%. So that was pretty cool. Anyway, we bought this house on Mercer Island, and we're a couple blocks from the Catholic school there, so my kids could go to school. I'm living in a 5-bedroom house on Mercer Island. I can even convince myself I'm a success, except the finances were just, of course, my wife had no idea. I didn't even have any idea, except I just needed more money. And they had this, let me see where I want to go here. Any rate, my wife was getting tired of my drinking. And at one point, we were involved with the church a little bit, you know, because you're supposed to get involved in your parish. And one time she had me meet her at the church, and it was after work, and she said, "Just show up." And I thought it was some committee meeting or something. So I go in to this little office, and there's these kind of chairs in a circle. And there's this part of I think alcoholics have this gene in their brain that says, "This isn't going to end well." So my wife and a few people are sitting around the chairs, and the parish priest and this guy from, you know, probably Milam's or whatever they had back then. And they all said, "Stephen, we've got something to say to you. We want to, you know, will you listen?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, will you have a seat?" And I probably said, "No." So, you know, "Stephen, we love you. We're concerned about your drinking, you know, blah, blah, blah," each person. And so I'm listening to them all, and I'm trying to keep a straight face. And the guy says, "How much do you drink, would you say, in a typical week?" Can I remember my wife's there? So I'm thinking in my head, I'm going to add up a day and then multiply it by 7. And then I'm going to immediately cut it in half. And then I got to see how much I can shave off of that, because I can't be too much of a lie because she's there. She knows I'm drinking every night. So I think, what an odd question. So I try to do the math in my head, and I said, "Well, probably about whatever the number was," I said. And he goes like this. And I said, "What?" And he said, "You drink that much every week?" And I'm thinking in my head, that's so much less than I drink, you know. I really blew this one. And he said, "Stephen, do you think you have a drinking problem? And I said, no. And he turned to my wife and he said, I'd file for divorce. And I said, to hell with you. I said, you asked me to be honest and I'm being honest. And he said, Stephen, I believe you. I really believe you're being honest. And I think she should file for divorce. And so, you know, I left there. And she didn't then, but she did. A year later, I was behaving. I wasn't taking my marital vows very seriously. Not at all. And she had had enough. So on November 1st, I had to get to AA. That was in August. And she came with me to my first meeting. The reason she came with me, because earlier than that, she told me to go to AA or else. And I went to the bar and came back and said, I went to AA and they were full. But a couple of the men talked to me afterwards. I said, I was really like embarrassed and ashamed at first, but my lies just picking up speed. And I said, they asked me about my drinking and I told them, and they said, I got to watch it. You know, I just got to watch it. So anyway, one of my wife's sisters said, you got to tell Stephen to go to AA or divorce him. And she said, oh, he already tried that, but they were full. And her sister had some experience with Al-Anon. And she said, he's just lying to you. So we went together to my first meeting. That was August 14th, 1986. And I didn't like any part of it. I didn't want to stop drinking. And after the meeting, they had a tradition which I wasn't in favor of at all. They held hands. And there happened to be, my wife was on one side of me, but there was a guy on the other side of me, and I wasn't part of that tradition. So I'm still, what the hell's going on? I'm storming out. And this guy stopped my wife and said, that's your husband? And she said, yeah. And she said, he's drunk. And I thought, okay, hell with AA. I mean, what is this guy deal? You know, you don't tell. And he said, I'm asking you this because if you needed a ride home. And she said, no, we're in separate cars. And that guy said to me, I'm going to pick you up tomorrow and we're going to go to another meeting. And I'm like, what? And he said, yeah, we're going to go to another meeting. And I thought, honest to God, in my head, I've been to AA. I mean, I didn't know people came back. I didn't know that. You know, you go there and it works or it doesn't. It didn't. And that's the end of it. So I had no desire to stop drinking, none. And I don't know why I agreed to go to a meeting with him the next day. But for the next 3 years, I didn't miss a single day. And in that time, I made some friends. I got past the first person I recognized in AA, of course, was in the car business, Daryl Smith. And I saw him and I just thought I'd die. You know, oh God, he'll recognize me. And he said, Steve, you know, come here. And I said, you know, I'm apologizing to him. You know, God, I'm so sorry. I try to explain, I don't belong here, you know. And he said, hey, he said, it's okay. He said, your secret's safe with me. Nobody will ever have to know that you're trying to get well. And then his friends are kind of laughing, and I didn't get it. But I made good friends. And like I said, for the next 3 years, I didn't miss a meeting. And I got sicker and sicker. The real misery in my life came after being in AA, being a real alcoholic, knowing everything there is to know, but I didn't have a solution. I just thought I did. And my solution was go to meetings, get involved. You know, I started out cleaning ashtrays under supervision because they didn't want me putting hot ashes in the wastebasket. Moved up to coffee cups, graduated to chairs, and you know, eventually the secretary and all that stuff. So in my mind, I was pretty just about Mr. AA, but I had no solution. My life was horrible. It was so bad. And anyway, ran into some people that were living in the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous provides us through the steps, and just asked me simple, how'd you like to get well? And I'm like, well, you're making an assumption there. We heard your story. You know, there's not much to assume. You're dying of alcoholism. And I'm saying, I haven't had a drink in 3 years. And it's like, I was probably Jeffrey that said it. Hey, I haven't had a drink in 1 year and I'm way more well than you, which was true. So I got involved in the steps and my life changed. And until I got involved in the steps, I didn't think I needed it more than I already had it. Because I said in the beginning before I introduced Ulf, I hear things differently. Like when they talk, starting out in the doctor's opinion about a complete psychic change, I thought that an entire psychic change, that those are the exact words. I'm thinking, well, some changes, you know, some changes. And then later on, we see as a result of the steps in Dr. Paul's story where he says, to live a happy life, you have to live life on life's terms only. And I thought, okay, well, I want to live life on life's terms when they seem to suit me. Until somebody asked me, Steve, what are the terms of life? You're always pitching about living life on life's terms. And I would say, well, you know, am I out?
No.
Oh.
I'm sorry. You have about 5 minutes.
Okay. I would say, well, you know, and this man who became a mentor of mine said, I actually do know, but do you? And I said, actually, I don't. You know, I want happiness. According to the AA literature, I'll only be happy if I live life on life's terms. And I don't know what the terms of life are. And it's not bothering me. I'm just going about my merry way. So I did some investigation, and I found out the way I understand it is the terms of life say that every circumstance you're in can be looked at as helpful. If you see something as helpful, you'll be grateful. Grateful people are happy. And I'm thinking, okay, that makes sense. And let me tell you how this person over here screwed me over. And said, well, Steve, you're not getting it. I started to see things that, other things in the book that I interpreted differently. Like our literature is clear that we create our own misery. And I can open the page and read you it's clear, by now it's clear that we created our own misery. And then I tell you how somebody else made me miserable, some other situation. I couldn't see the contradictions until I was ready to see them. And I thought, God, there's a whole nother AA here where people get well. And I didn't even know it was there. People that don't live in contradiction, people that are happy because they're living life on life's terms, and people that have accepted that it will continue for a lifetime. It's a reconstruction period. And I've had some, not time tonight, but I've had some great stories where I could tell you a massive wrongdoing to me personally. Massive wrongdoing, and something that could never be forgiven. And I would talk to somebody. It's really, there's one really cool thing in AA. Not everybody's insane at the same time. So I could talk to somebody else and say, here's what happened. And I'm giving factual stuff as I believe it's factual. How could I look at this and be happy? And it's never once failed me where somebody said, well, Steve, you could look at it this way. And it's like, huh. But I've got all this rage and stuff built up from the way I'm looking at it. Yeah, how's that feel? You know, you could look at it this way and walk away with peace in your heart. And that's, for me, I got to see that's where the work of AA comes in. Am I willing? Is that a length I'm willing to go to be at peace instead of having rage and murder in my heart? And I got tired of it. And so that's the fellowship of the spirit that I got involved in, where people, as a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're happy because they live life on life's terms. And part of being happy is passing it on when we can. And sometimes we go through these steps. Actually, Nancy and I are in our 12th group now since COVID. And sometimes people say, hey, thanks. That was pretty cool. Except it's always me that should be thanking them, because I get to see on a deeper level how beautiful a world we live in because of the people that participate in my life with me. Okay, I think that's about it.
Thanks.
Like Lara.
Yes.